Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. Welcome to the third edition of what has become a three-part series on the films of 1999. My name is Rob Farley, and I was joined for this podcast by Scott Lemieux and Dave Watkins. Please enjoy.
All right, so number two, back to a Tom Cruise film. And I don't remember if we saw this one together either. I think we did, but I'm actually not sure about that.
I'm sure I saw it with you guys, and then I think I saw it again with Stephanie. So I think I saw it twice in its theatrical run. And I think all three of us, we've been there all along, right? Like, I think we've all liked this from the beginning.
Yeah.
We're not part of the sort of bandwagon crowd, even though, and it is fascinating that now it turns out to have been a documentary. I think we were on board with it even on first viewing.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like its reputation has sort of had all these twists and turns, and I've never really followed it too closely because it just seemed like an obviously outstanding movie, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't even think Tom Cruise is necessarily that great. Like Tom Cruise is the incel guy in Magnolia is kind of indispensable for the part. Tom Cruise is fine here, but I don't know that he's
I think Roy Droz has made this point that like Scorsese and like Anderson, like he's really cast almost for what he doesn't do. Like he's absolutely perfect as like a callow guy who's confident while being in over his head. And I'm sure there are other people who could have done that, but he actually does it pretty well.
And
I mean, Scott, you've talked about that great scene towards the end around the pool table with Sidney Pollack and Tom Cruise, where, you know, Cruise is just so out of his depth, and you don't know how much of that is his acting and how much of that is, you know, him just being out of his depth, but it's worked so well.
Yeah, and Sidney Pollack was a great, you know, and as a director, he had his moments, you know, not so much towards the end, but he was a wonderful character actor. And that's one of his greatest scenes. One of my favorite scenes in any movie the last 25 years is the scene in A Civil Action where John Travolta is playing the, you know, the lawyer challenging the polluting companies. And he's like the general counsel of like the biggest fish that is being sued. And so he makes Travolta meet at the Harvard Club and then starts saying, of course, we cannot discuss business at the Harvard Club. So they have to like have this 3-hour lunch. And then they finally go. And then Pollock says, you know, well, why don't I see you here more often? And you know, the Travolta character says, well, you know, I went to Cornell. And Pollock pauses and says, Cornell, that's a good school. You know, it's just like the most, and the way he does it is just phenomenal. It was just perfect. Which you can imagine, even if you haven't seen the movie, if you've seen like Pollock is just, you know, just delivers it just perfectly. And same thing, like he's really crucial here. You know, it's kind of sort of, you know, superficially respectable, you know, guy who's involved. And again, just all the more resonant now. But yeah, it's really well done. And just some of the, you know, and obviously you're free not to like the movie, but some of the initial criticisms are just like, well, you know, people were really offended that like late Kubrick movies were filmed on location. Like there's those, you know, New York City isn't just a city. It's a character. Like, you know, it's like not every movie has to be Taxi Driver. You know, like it's not about New York City. Like you're missing the point. It doesn't like, who cares? You know, that this is not really a documentary of what it would be like to be a physician in New York City. And like who gives a shit? You know, that the whole point is it's supposed to be like this quasi dreamlike state. So I even think that the London sets work really well. There's just like so many indelible scenes. And it's also amazing that they got that the creepy costume store owner looks exactly like Patrick. Like, just perfect. You know, just amazing. The other dumb criticism is like the orgy isn't erotic. Like it's not supposed to be. You kidding? Like that's the fucking point. Like my God.
I really do wonder. I'd be fascinated to peek into some alternative universe where this is like the first film of some unknown director. What would the critical response have been? Like, because I think so many weird expectations people have with Kubrick that they know what a Kubrick film is supposed to be, and they have issues with Kubrick, and like, you know, just because so many of the critiques of this film just were baffling to me. I don't understand what they saw. I don't know what they were talking about.
I mean, as much as the, and it, Some complaints I've had have actually been about sort of the first scene, which is at the party at Sidney Pollack's house, and that which people don't like it for various reasons. But I mean, I love that first scene. I love just the seductive conversation that Kidman is having with the Hungarian count, which is just actually probably the most. I mean, it's the most erotic part of the entire film. It's just the conversation. Right. I mean, she's quite drunk, and he's attempting to seduce her and failing, barely. But it's a great scene. But what I also love about it is, like, you know, it just, like, oh, well, heck, you know, Sidney Pollack is here naked with a cooked-up prostitute. Well, that's not unusual.
Right, yeah, just completely like it's another. Yeah. This is what we expect.
Matter of fact, okay.
Yeah.
Take your ibuprofen, call me in the morning.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's just, you know, like it really is just like it's you know, that the whole movie is like, you know, you don't, like, to a Tom Cruise, like, you don't want to know what's going on. And that's, you know, been really pounded. And we should talk about Kidman also, who's terrific in this movie. Really. Mm-hmm. And Kubrick movies aren't always about, like, the performances, although, you know, he's gotten many over the years. But, you know, that she's actually, like, works really well. And Cruise is a bigger part of the movie, obviously. But Kidman's role is really perfect. And I agree. Like, the first scene with Hungarian, the perfectly chosen waltz, you know, it's really good. And I love the piano player character, too. Is really
right. From Seattle. Nick from Seattle, I think.
Yeah, Nick. Right. Oh, and then Alan Cumming has that great cameo as the hotel.
I would also single out that for Kidman in particular, that scene where she and Cruise have like an ill-conceived argument about their marriage while high. It's just phenomenal. It's
yeah.
And that's really more about her than him. That's she's carrying the weight in that.
He recognizes that women have feelings in those lower parts too, right? It's like the first time it's ever occurred to him that might happen. Yeah. So, all right. So number one on this list, which is not going to be the final movie we're going to discuss, is Being John Malkovich, which is crazy, and I think about it a lot, but I have not probably seen it since 2000. It's been a long time since either. I've watched this movie.
I've seen it more recently, and interestingly, it's interesting these are the top two because they're both essentially about men being terrified of genuine female sexuality at bottom. But it still has been a while for a movie that, you know, and the thing is, I think part of this is that it's actually a very difficult movie to watch. Like, it's actually a very raw movie about misogyny, going along with that. And it's really, but it's just super, you know, I mean, Catherine Keener is another just splendid character actor. Malkovich is perfect in this role. And I love the scene where, because it is like, Malkovich is a great actor. And I also have trouble, you know, at least before this round, is like identifying the movies he was in. It is.
He's in that Jewel Thief movie. You remember? He was in that Jewel Thief movie.
Yeah. And of course, Burn after reading, too. But, just everything about this. And Cameron Diaz is very good. Cusack is perfectly cast as the nice guy in a pejorative sense. And this is one of the movies to really dissect that, that it's actually like a really feminist movie and really well done. But it is, like, I think that one reason that it's not a movie I watch all the time is that it's a difficult movie. But I definitely think it's Jones's best. And I really like, although no, he didn't direct Eternal Sunshine, right? Which I think is really good, although it's marred by the fact that Jim Carrey just doesn't work in the lead role. This movie is really like cast from the get-go, and I love it. But I do think that's if I had to identify a reason why I haven't been compelled to watch it as much as some of these other ones, is that it's actually a difficult and very emotionally, you know, tough experience. But I think it's a good choice for number one. I have trouble ranking these, but it's as good as anything. I agree.
I think what you're thinking of is that Charlie Kaufman was one of the writers on Eternal
Sunshine. Yes, that's right. Did Kaufman actually direct Eternal Sunshine?
No, it's Michel Gondry.
That's right. And he wrote both. That's right. So I'm getting that sort of universe confused. Yeah.
And I do sort of those two kind of cross in my mind sometimes. Like, I think their connection on Eternal Sunshine might be part of why, but
Yeah, and I think and I think a lot of people prefer Eternal Sunshine, and I, it's fun. It's really good, but and there are rules in which I find Carrey acceptable, but I really don't like him in that for whatever reason. It doesn't work for me. But that's probably my thing. Not really.
I mean, for me, one of the reasons that this is such a difficult film to watch, and it is in the end just completely cruel to its primary subject, right? I mean, essentially what we have here is the character here, John Malkovich, played by John Malkovich, is essentially tortured, and then his life is stolen, right? And he has nothing to do. He can't do anything about it, right? I mean, he is sort of completely unable to resist this thing, this awful thing being done to him, right? Which is even sort of triumphal, right? In the end, when everybody's creeping into his head so they can live in his body, there's just an extraordinary cruelty to the end of this film.
Yeah, and what's amazing is that it's the kind of high concept that should not be able to be carried through, and that does. And I would say, our friend of the blog, Glenn Kenny, is a huge fan of Schenectady, New York, another Kaufman, which I think Kaufman did direct.
Yeah, he did.
That's a movie, I think, with a high concept that just runs off. It's just trying to do so much, and it's just so bleak that he can't pull it all together. Like, it just goes off the rails, even though it has a lot of like really good scenes. But this is just like, it's a high concept that he shouldn't be able to bring in, and he just lands it perfectly. Like, it's really kind of amazing.
Okay, so we had agreed to talk about five other films that weren't on this particular list, but that were on the Ringer list of the best 50. And I want to start with Go, which is certainly a movie I really enjoyed at the time. Again, I haven't seen it in a while. It is kind of interesting that that Sarah Polley, in a lot of ways, is connected with the entire sort of the Weinstein scandal, right? That her career isn't quite ruined, but it's certainly altered by the Weinstein scandal. But sort of at this point, she was just sort of a very well-known and young actress who seemed to have a tremendously bright future in front of her, and things worked out differently for her. And I guess the other one who really comes out of this, Katie Holmes, yes, but Tim Oliphant, right, who I forget he's in this movie, but he's so terrific in it. And he's terrific in it in a way, like, I think that he's actually not good in the first season of Deadwood. Like, I think he becomes a much better actor across the series, but he's really good in this role in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. That's the biggest reason. I think this is one of the disputes our blog had with Euglacius. I guess why Stills really like me very much. But, but the second season of Deadwood is just very obviously better than the first. And the biggest thing is that, and admittedly, it's not entirely, it's partly his acting, and I think partly that the character is really underwritten. Like, it took them a while to figure out that character had to be more interesting to compete with Swearengen and the other, there was just kind of a tabula rasa. But his acting, but it's also the kind of role that a really good actor can sell, even if it's not really written. And he doesn't really do that. But I agree that in Go, he's terrific. And I have watched it recently because, again, I'm always on the lookout for movies I like that are available in $5 Blu-rays or whatever. So, it was a couple years ago I watched it. I think it holds up, it's a really fun, and again, also makes use of the sort of, multiple perspectives, in ways that are really good. There's also the guy from Party of Five is actually pretty good at it too. Like his name. By the way, one thing we should mention with Polly is that, despite the sort of anchor that Weinstein put in her career, she has directed two of my favorite movies the last 15 years or so in Away From Her and Take This Waltz. So she's actually a really gifted director, although I haven't seen her.
That's interesting.
Which is good. So yeah, but I mean, she's like a very, I mean, obviously this could be Canadian chauvinism on my part, but it's a and I think she was, a really, really principled and committed person, which I think you can see in her directing.
Didn't she shortly after this, she did that. I think it was what was that? Catherine Bigelow's first movie. It was set in Nova Scotia. It was had Elizabeth Hurley.
The Weight of Water. We saw that at Seattle Film Festival.
Yes, that's right. We did. That was good.
Yeah, it was in 2000. Yeah, that was And that movie, I don't. Did he even get like a major studio release?
I don't know.
Yeah, that wasn't a perfect movie, but I thought that was really, you know, and particularly given the renown that Bigelow was, which I think largely justly gotten later. Yeah, and that didn't it, like Sean Penn in it. It was really like
right.
Yeah. Yeah, like I'm not saying it was, you know, it was not. I'm not saying it's a lost masterpiece or anything, but
I distinctly remember really liking Polly's performance in that too. And
well, yeah, Sweeter After, go, like, I think as well.
Unbelievable. One thing about Go that I remember, it's been ages since I've seen it. Is that like it's one of those movies, and the Ocean's movies I put in this category too. Of like you typically think that there's only like so much that can be achieved in a film through really good pacing, right. And this is one of those movies that sort of breaks through that ceiling. Like the pacing is just so good, you know.
Right. The Ocean's movies are a good comparison because you know sit down. And if you actually think through the plots of the Ocean movies, like they're just absolutely ridiculous on every.
Yeah.
But the point is not, you know, like acting in pace is what stops you from asking those questions.
Exactly.
So you could be a slow pace like Rafifi, but then the details actually have to be in place. Whereas in the Ocean's universe, the details have to be plausible given the ridiculous assumptions. But that also requires really, and I think not just pace, but acting. I think it also has to be funny, which is another thing about these movies.
Yeah.
You know, like a good movie should actually be funny and not solemn most of the time. And I think it does that really well. It gives a lot of really good scenes, and it's well done. By the way, the director, Doug Liman, because he directed Swingers too, right? But he's now gone into kind of do blockbusters. He sort of had an interesting career. Because, to go from Swingers to go to the Bourne Identity. That's kind of an interesting trajectory. But, I mean, if I recall correctly, I mean, the Bourne Identity is pretty good for what it is, right?
I mean, I think they got better when Greenglass started directing them, though, because I have seen all of them. And I think the Greenglass ones are better. So, I mean, everything we've just said about Go, right, in terms of the pacing and the humor, I think could also be said about the next one, which is Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, right? Is it Guy Ritchie's first film? I actually don't know if it's his first film, but it's his first sort of major film. And this is one I actually do see now and again, just because I just really enjoy it. Sort of back when Jason Statham sort of looked human. I also really liked the one that came after, also with Statham and with Brad Pitt as the gypsy boxer.
It's
a really fun movie, Lock, Stock.
Yeah. No, I've probably seen it 25. You know, it's just something that if it's on Netflix and I have nothing else in particular, like I'll just watch it. You know, it just uses music really well. Again, as you say, it's pacing. A lot of great character roles, and you know, Vinnie Jones.
We grow copious amounts of cannabis here, don't we?
Yeah. And it is really, really good. And I agree. Like, and so as we were talking about, that's, you know, Ritchie is somebody who had, you know, like one excellent and one very, very good movie in him. And the less said about the rest of his career, the better. but you know, that really is. And I did see he had kind of another heist movie, which was like better than Swept Away. Is Rock. And I actually saw Rock and Rolla. Which was, you know, it was like, it wasn't even terrible, but it was like, I can't imagine any circumstances under which I would see that rather than just watching Lock, Stock again. It did have Idris Elba. And obviously there is something like marrying Madonna just really does, you know, and then her forcing you to do her like vanity project is, you know, sort of, I mean, that's, you know, it's hard for your life to just completely emerge intact. I see from this, he directed the new Aladdin movie.
Oh, really?
Oh, really?
Oh, any idea about
that? No.
He directed
nothing.
The Man from U.N.C.L.E. I just had no idea whatsoever.
Yeah, I seem to remember, like, his Sherlock Holmes movie was reasonably well-regarded.
Like, and that was, yeah, people like those.
I found it just utterly, like, within hours of leaving the theater, I couldn't tell you anything about it. It was just, so I wasn't actively annoyed by how bad it was while watching it, but man, is it forgettable.
No, I think that's fair. Now here's, and I think this actually, so the next movie is, I think, probably the one that I have seen the most out of any movie on this list. And it may actually, I mean, so it would be competitive with The Matrix in terms of, like, I wonder what the total number of views are. Probably less than The Matrix, but it's one absolutely you would not expect, right? Which is Mike Judge's Office Space. Which just sort of captured a moment.
All
over it.
Yeah, and I think I saw that downtown either alone or I think with our friend Aaron. And yeah, it's really, you know, and again, it's a movie that just the, you know, and I think, yeah, and I think it is a movie that gets better over time. Like a lot of Judge projects, it just kind of like pulls up. So, you know, even is really good. And I've actually liked it. And what's unfortunate is that the stupid Idiocracy movie has actually gotten a lot of, which is actually pretty bad. I actually like the Extract. I don't know if you guys have seen that. Jason Bateman is actually pretty good. Although not as good as Office Space, but yeah, it's just, you know, the best scenes in this movie are so good and so perfect. You know, and then even like the sort of, you know, so there are scenes that are kind of filler but work okay. You know, like I wouldn't say like, you know, the romantic subplot kind of scenes tacked on, although it does give us the amazing scene with like I wish there had been more of Aniston's Office Space and less of the, you know, because so much more can be done with working in a chain restaurant. That's kind of a lost opportunity there. Like that, it, like I can imagine an even better movie that paralleled being an office drone with like working in the food services industry rather than just kind of making her the, you know, the kind of the tack on. But that's really a minor quibble. I mean, it's so well done.
The pieces of flair sequence makes up for quite a bit of, you know, that, right? I think, Rob, I think you said, like, this is, you know, one of the most profound statements on contemporary capitalism.
Yeah.
If you just want to do the minimum. Yeah, that's exactly what I want to do. That's why I'm here. I want to do the minimum.
And it's hard to pick a favorite. I mean, probably my favorite, like the scenes with the consultants are probably my favorite scenes. And it's like, I treasure the whole catalog. And it's like, what would you say that you do here? Which is interesting in that, you know, it's really, you know, it's just.
I'm a people person.
You can't talk to the customers. They can't talk to them. I'm glad that it got certification back. And if I recall at the time, it was a bit of a flaw. It was not a commercial success, despite the fact Judge being really hot after Beavis and Butthead. And I'm not really sure why. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not an inaccessible movie. It's very funny. You know, it's odd sometimes what works in the box office and what doesn't. But yeah, for whatever reason. But I think that it's now pretty much firmly established in the. Just because, you know, a movie with like so many scenes that are that indelible is ultimately going to find its audience.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking of indelible, the last two films. So the first one, and you guys are going to viciously mock me for this, and that's fine, of course, is The Phantom Menace, which I believe I saw at midnight on opening night, like any good red-blooded American. Scott, you're not even American, so you don't count. And Dave, you know, you're obviously something wrong with you. You know, I mean, what I'll say about it, I've watched it again. It's not a good film, but my daughters really like it. I mean, they really enjoy it. And it's certainly better than the second one. So,
how old do they have to be before you make fun of them for that?
You can make fun of them anytime you want. Anytime you want, Dave. For whatever.
Well, no, I assume it's sort of slightly different rules for you. But yeah.
No, I make fun of them all the time. I'm a cruel parent. Cruel.
Yeah. So I have not seen either any of that. No, I was about to say next two. There's now like what 20 or something. But yeah, I actually watched at least an hour of this because, you know, back when I was still watching The Simpsons every Sunday. And what's amazing is that, like, I was about to give up on The Simpsons more or less when The Phantom Menace came out, and it's still going. Like, that's probably it. And, you know, like, there are, you know, I will say about The Simpsons that there are more good individual episodes in, like, the seasons between, like, 8 and about 14 than is sometimes acknowledged. You know, without any of those seasons being good overall. And I also don't really, and I think Emily Vanderwoof wrote a good piece that I don't really get this idea that I'm supposed to like the first seasons less because it's gone on too long. Like, I never really understand I've never understood that logic at all. Like, who cares? Like, if they just want to keep making, you know, money watching the most people won't watch, it's fine. But anyway, so I was expecting to watch The Simpsons, and it came on, and this is the day before, you know, you had a, you know, I had the hockey package on cable or whatever. So I watched it, and what amazed me is that it's supposed to be this, like, you know, it's like, you know, and I mean, I don't really like any Star Wars movie except for Empire. Like, I'm that kind of, you know, but I think even if you're not, don't really like the first movie, you have to acknowledge it's like, it's real, like, archetypal power. Like, it's a fun, you know, like, you are, like, I think you would have to be like completely out of touch not to understand why people love it, even if you don't personally. Whereas this movie, it's like, there's this whole, like, 5-minute introduction about how it's some kind of fucking trade war. And it's like, you know, and the movie is exactly that boring. Like, it really, it's not like it's, you know, it's not
a
like
tariff dispute. A tariff dispute. It's the tariff.
Yeah. And it's not like it's like, okay, well, with that out of the way, now we're going to have like an exciting mansion movie. Like, it's just this incredibly slow and deep. And like, and the thing is that if you're going to have that kind of movie, you really need like good acting. And it's not that there aren't good actors in this. It's that like they get like, you know, McGregor is horrible. Portman is horrible. Like, these are talented people, like Liam Neeson. You know, I would say it's fair to say that like Hayden Christensen is not very talented, although Billy Ray did get a good performance out of him.
Right. Lucas is the anti Tarantino, the anti Scorsese, right? I mean, he gets bad performances out of good actors.
Right. And he only like is he didn't direct it, he directed the first one, but not Empire, correct?
Did not direct Empire or Jedi.
Right, yeah, which I think improved. And as for his writing, I think even, well, there's the legendary Harrison Ford line, like, you can type this shit, George, but you sure can't say it. But again, it's like, you know, in the originals, like, the bad dialogue is almost part of the charm. Well, you know, like, you're not going to see, like, a good space opera for, like, you know, really well, you know, if you get it, it's great. But that's not really like essential. But it is a problem if you're basically going to try to make some kind of like, you know, complicated, like, highbrow, you know, like, to say something positive about it, you can't say that it's not ambitious. You know, it's not, it's definitely not a profit taking cynical corporate enterprise. Like, that's a, it is certainly a personal vision. You know, the problem is that, like, Lucas doesn't seem to understand what he does well, but I can't say that it's like a sellout. You know, that is one thing, right, to say. Like, you know, like, it's certainly like Lucas did not make that film to make money. You can admire that. And Lucas is, like, in a weird way, he has always been, if anything, more idealistic than his old friend Coppola, you know, who has definitely directed a lot of movies for money. And, you know, like, I think Lucas really, like, he really is a principled person. You know, and I think that he really is, like, committed to his vision. You get to sense, like, he sees distant from Hollywood. Like, you can't imagine him being involved in any, like, Me Too scandals or anything. Like, I think in many ways he's actually, like, quite an admirable figure. But, you know, that doesn't mean that I would, like, dream of ever watching this again in a million years. But, you know, it is. Although I am actually interested that your daughters would like it, because it wouldn't strike me as a movie that kids would like. What do you think the appeal is?
Well, I mean, kids like the Jar Jar Binks character. Kids are less troubled by the bad dialogue. And in general, right, I mean, I think people generally do acknowledge about this film is it does have the best lightsaber fight of the entire series, right, at least through 8 movies so far. With sort of the Darth Maul against the Qui-Gon Jinn and Obi-Wan scene. That is extremely well done. It's just that the rest of the movie isn't. So,
fair.
All right. So, speaking of problematic movies, so the last movie we're going to discuss tonight is the movie that won the Best Picture Oscar for 1999, and that, you know, I remember really liking, and then, like, for not long after, I sort of was curious, why did I like that? It's American Beauty, right, which, you know, now, and in fact, I think the AV Club even has an article, what happened to American Beauty, right? I mean, how did we like it so much then when it's so obviously problematic in so many ways? And I don't mean just problematic in terms of political problematic. I mean, like, the story is bad in lots of really identifiable ways that, you know, we should have been smarter about back in 99.
Right, right. Some of us may have even found the stupid plastic bag thing mildly poignant at first, and then what the hell happened?
Right. Like, what the hell?
What was going on?
I will say, and I fully copped, like, and well, so I think, Dave, you and I saw this at a free sneak preview at the Broadway Theater.
That's right.
And I don't remember how we got it, but we did, and I think we all saw it. Yeah, and like, I don't think I ever liked that. Like, I know at the beginning, I didn't like the plastic bag stuff, and I did not like the, wow, it turns out that the homophobe is gay twist. What I do think I was much more, you know, and first of all, is that, like, the one thing is that, like, Mendez is a very good visual director, which can cause you to overlook some stuff. You know, I was a lot younger, so probably more sympathetic to, like, you know, banal criticisms of the sub, you know, which I now recognize, you know. And the thing is, Benning gives, and in fact, I've even had people in my mentions try to suggest that that character is not misogynist as written, which is just the most ridiculous bullshit I've ever heard. But I think it happens in part because, like, Benning really does give a character that soul that is nowhere in the screenplay. Like, you know, like, on paper, even remotely sympathetic for a second. But I think Benning does actually try to invest that character with something. Or the idea that, like, oh, it's actually just as critical of space. He's like, no. No, this was not revolutionary. It's clearly, you know, it's just like no, you know. But yeah, it's just, you know, but like obviously even, in, you know, and I think even pretty quickly you recognize, you know, like it's about like an overgrown adult, you know, and that's, and so many cliches, like, you know, men, you know, find their essence by fantasizing about 18-year-old. And it's like as if the fact that he doesn't sleep with her somehow redeems that plot arc, you know, it's not, you know. And just the idea
that's
that,
the,
like, you know,
what the hell moment. And this actually, and honestly, this was the one that I did sort of, that really bothered me at the moment. It's right. It's like, we are supposed to be impressed with him because he decided not to commit statutory rape. And I think she's 17, 16 or 17. I don't think she's 18.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He's a hero because he decided not to rape her because she was a virgin. Right.
That's
it is.
Right.
I mean, really?
That's right.
What? What?
Yeah. He didn't even come to the realization, like, wait, this would be deeply wrong. It's like, well, if I'd be your second, you know, that would be fine. You know, like,
God. Look, as long as you're a slut, it was going to be okay. But since you're not, I really feel bad about it.
Yeah. And also, like, critiques of, like, the suburbs, like, lose their force when it's like, oh, I want to live in this nice house. I just don't want to have, like, a demanding job. Like, you know, as long as my wife pays for it, you know, it does sort of, you know, like, nobody doesn't move out or anything. You know, like, you know, like, he just decides, you know, oh, I don't really want to, like, work long hours anymore, you know? And, like, I want to criticize my wife's taste in furniture. Like, it's not exactly the kind of... And I think the contrast really is, because what's interesting is that Mendez would go on to direct Revolutionary Road, which I think is so, like, you know, not so much, like, his movie is not fully successful, but I don't know, have you guys ever read the novel, Richard Gates's novel?
No.
Yeah. So what's amazing, and the movie does, I think, convey to some extent, is that it seems like it's a movie about how the suburbs are, like, you know, killing these people. But the novel is actually, and Del Waldman actually had a great review of this, like, the whole point of the novel is that it's about them. It's not about the suburbs. Like, you know, they have plenty of opportunities to live in the city. Like, they're always talking about it. It's like, you know, there's nothing about the suburbs that causes people to be how they are. Like, people are how they are. Like, that's literally the whole point of the novel. It's about people blaming, like, bland 50s suburban culture for just being people who, like, aren't adventurous but want to think of themselves as sort of being more adventurous than they are. And the sort of character played by Michael Shannon in the movie is, like, you know, portrayed as mentally ill because he's just constantly pointing this, you know, like, subtly pointing this out. You know, and so, like, the fact that that novel was written in the early 60s and then to see this movie come, you know, after so many, like, my theory is that, like, if the thesis of your film can be summed up better by 3 minutes in a Rush song, then it's not really good. And that's pretty much, like, you know, it's like the most banal thing, but there's no hint at all that any of this is just like that, like, Spacey is like an overgrown adolescent. This is very much this, like, crushing conformity of, and the Cooper. And I think, yeah, the Cooper scenes even at the time are just, you know, it's just,
yeah, not, know, good. It's like, not good.
Yeah.
It's really, but I think that the reason that it got, is that you can really see this is the fact that, yeah, like it's, you know, like, you know, Mendez is not untalented. And I actually kind of like The Road to Perdition, which nobody ever talks about anymore as follow up. And it wasn't perfect, but I must admit, I haven't like felt compelled to watch it again since I thought in the theater, but I kind of liked it. I mean, it was visually telling it. And, you know, look, I'm, you know, Spacey deserves to be canceled and I'm fully on board with his cancellation, but like, he really is a very, very gifted actor. And we've already talked about Benning. Also Thora Birch, and I have a terrible collection of celebrity birthdays. She's one of the few good ones, who is splendid in that, and even better in Ghost World. And I have not, what has she been in? So that's another, that's an actor I'd love to know if there's some sort of backstory about her career that we don't know, something Weinstein-like, but like, she is actually really good in this.
Yeah, she is.
You know, so who played the video teenager, I forget?
Wes Bentley.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think you've sort of identified most of the reasons people liked this back then, right? That it sort of had this superficial edginess, right? It was anti-capitalist and anti-conformity, and there was the gay neighbors that everybody really liked, and you know, also that Spacey and Benning are both just really outstanding in this. Yeah, but I mean, it's one of those where I really wish I had sort of paid more attention to like, you know, I won't say that I was completely sold on it, because I did think, you know, there were some key problems to it. But that I liked it as much as I did is still pretty surprising.
Well, right. I identified most of the flaws in real time and I still thought it was a great movie.
Yeah. Right.
Just confuses. Like, I want to send a good interviewer back in time to grab me as I'm coming out of the theater and just sit down and figure out what was going on.
Yeah, I don't know about great, but certainly very, like, a movie that I liked and enjoyed. But it is, you know, it's a movie that is appealing to the prejudice of the kind of, you know, single white guy in their mid to late 20s who would go to grad school.
It won the Best Picture, right? It wasn't just us, right?
Oh, good point.
It was almost universally beloved, and it won the Best Picture, and people generally agreed. It's like, okay, yeah, you're right. I mean, nobody at the time thought that this was a really bad choice as Best Picture. And maybe that just says more about how we think about Best Pictures, right? But it was like, you wouldn't have listed this, you know, in your top 20 of bad choices for Best Picture at the time, right? I mean, you know, we have a better sense of it now, but...
Yeah. But yeah, and that's good. But I think part of what may explain the appeal to the Academy is that you mentioned anti-capitalist, but it's a movie that is only anti-capitalist in the most superficial sense. That, like, you know, like, I want to be able to, like, tell my boss to take my job and sub it, but I'm just assuming that I have a wife who will allow me to maintain the suburban lifestyle to which I am accustomed. You know, so it's very much it's a superficially anti-capitalist message that would appeal to somebody living in Hollywood who doesn't have a boss telling them what to do. Right, but who keeps all the privileges of living in Brentwood or the Hollywood Hills or whatever. So I do think that it is, you know, and again, I think that, like, you know, Toothlessness is not a big deal when it's like a comedy like Bowfinger, which I think is just trying to be nice. But like, Toothlessness in something it is actually supposed to be satirical, you know, is much more of a problem. And again, particularly just the just utter, you know, and everything about how the Spacey characters are played out is incredibly cringy, even before we get to the fact that, like, Spacey is in real life a sexual predator.
You know, all right, guys. Well, I have to call time on this, but we have made it through all of these, and so
we did. Thank
you
guys
so much for joining us, and listeners, thank you for joining us as well, and we hope you will listen in again in the future.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks very much.
All right, see you later.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.